Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set here.
Any program about science or scientists today is almost bound to focus on space.
Hey, Houston, the Challenger has landed.
Houston Station, we are ready for the event. Thank you.
Hello, it's Space Boffins with Richard Hollingham and Sue Nelson in partnership with the Naked Scientists. And can it really be 6 months since Europe landed on a comet?
We'll be catching up with Rosetta as Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko gets even closer to the sun, increasing the chances of the Philae lander coming back to life.
We'll be talking to some of the key members of the Rosetta team about what really happened during the landing, and I'll meet the man in charge of Philae's power.
We're joined by science writer, space journalist, author, and heavy rock lead guitarist Stuart Clarke. Although technically we're joining him as he's finishing another book. So we've come to your home, and we want to prove it that we're at your home because your guitar is right with you.
There we go. There's a chord that's guaranteed to get every Rush fan in the country on their feet.
There's probably a Venn diagram of Space Boffin listeners and Rush fans.
They're probably pretty close, actually.
Yeah.
Now, you've followed Rosetta, like me, really, every step of the way, but in your case, for the Guardian newspaper. Why do you think it has generated so much excitement, not just in the UK, but elsewhere?
I think it's for a number of reasons, but the biggest reason is that it was just so simple to understand the outline of the mission. You know, first, would it wake up? Would it arrive at the comet? Would it land on a comet? You know, it's just feels so ambitious, which it was. I mean, it was groundbreaking, historic, and it was just something. The comet was beautiful, and so it was just something that everyone could instinctively understand.
It's also, particularly when you go to the States, it appears to have raised the profile of Europe in space. On the day of landing, you had that wonderful NASA spokesman, which to me gave the best description ever, when he said, "How audacious!" And he actually added a bit of va-va-voom to actually remind people that, yeah, look what you've done.
I think that's absolutely true. I think Europe has not had the kind of razzmatazz about it that America and NASA so naturally generate. And yet we do these extraordinary, amazing things. And why not? Let's celebrate how good we actually are.
And we have to remind ourselves as well that, and I know ESA, the European Space Agency, are very keen to remind people that it's not over yet. This mission is halfway through it, really.
Yes, I think the greatest legacy of Rosetta will arrive in the years to come as we fully analyse the data and we truly build up the picture of these comets, what they are, how they contributed to the early solar system, and what they represent today.
Cinq, quatre, trois, deux, un, top. Allumage Vulcain. Décollage.
It's been a bumpy, not to mention bouncy, ride. Since its launch in 2004, the spacecraft has pinged around the solar system like a snooker ball, round Mars once and the Earth three times, and then out as far as the orbit of Jupiter. It's coped with a 31-month hibernation and finally caught up with Comet 67P at 55,000 kilometres per hour. Then, on the 12th of November last year, flight controllers at the European Space Operations Centre, that's ESOC, at Darmstadt in Germany, released the Philae lander. But But the landing didn't go entirely to plan. 6 months on, for a BBC Future website special, I've been talking to Koen Gertz from the lander team, former mission manager Fred Janssen, spacecraft operations manager Andrea Akamatsu, and first mission scientist Matt Taylor, who takes up the story on the eve of the landing.
The day before landing, on the 11th, there were some issues with the lander, and that was obvious in the faces of people when you could see the live feed. Now, I think German TV at least were on 24-hour coverage there. Everyone could see the streaming of the event all at that time. Ultimately, to enable the landing, we had a set of go and no-go scenarios. And we were approaching one, and we weren't sure whether we could go through it. And this was because we tried to prime one of the tanks on the lander. This was the active control system, basically a gas thruster on the top of the lander. And that didn't seem that it was working. So we had to have a meeting in what they call the fishbowl. It's just next to the main control room. And I've got a picture from that where we have everyone in there, Andrea, Sylvain, Fred, who is, you know, who's the mission manager and the one in charge of everything. So in terms of stress, he had the weight of the world on him because he's the one that says yes or no to things.
I wouldn't be good at my job if I got nervous about having to possibly make difficult calls. I had already made some very painful, to some people, calls by that time, but they needed to be made. So, yes, I felt some tension, but it wasn't that much. Then again, I'll be very honest, the day or the evening before landing, there were a few things which went wrong, and I was on my way to the hotel, and I hardly had I entered the lobby or I could turn around and walk back to Izok. And on the way back, I called my wife, and there were a few curses there.
Was there a point where you thought, actually, this might not work? Was there an issue with the lander itself?
It wasn't a matter of this won't work, but more we may not be able to do it now. And that, of course, knowing that there are hundreds of TV crews at Izok, everybody ready, we are some 17 hours away from when we should be landing, yeah, then the tension builds.
We went to have a gin and tonic to try and calm down a little bit, and we went into one of the bars, there's a hotel bar, but that was full of journalists, so we thought, well, we can't really have a decompression chat here, so we had to go in the smoking lounge of the hotel. Funnily enough, there's all these journalists and nobody smoking, yeah, how the world has changed. And we went in the smoking room to have a drink and have a chat about what had happened. We were there because, you know, basically we'd made the agreement had been made as to what the process was. Everything gets uplinked and then you just wait to see if the information comes back in about 4 hours' time. Fred and I said, look, let's go to bed. Text me when you hear anything. And I remember at 3 o'clock in the morning, you get the ping, we go. And then I went into ESOC and just sat in the main control room just watching events unfurl, as it were.
We take an image. It was exactly planned 50 seconds after the release and it worked perfectly well.
When I saw the images that Philae had really left, and when, of course, on the spacecraft we saw the information that the cable was detached, etc., yeah, that was a relief. But for me, the biggest tension moment was the landing itself.
I had a lot of pressure to announce the landing, definitely. So, but I made it very clear. It's very difficult first to detect exactly when it has landed because there's no indication of landing. We will see something happening. Second, we are not extremely familiar with the lander itself. We have a lander control center. They are more familiar, but they were receiving telemetry much later than what we did. And the third thing is also you don't know what is the lander doing when it lands. I mean, if it starts tumbling, whether it's anchored or not, it takes a long time to resolve these things. So when it came to the point where we thought it at landing or at least touchdown because we saw something changing and was exactly at the expected time, then I said, I believe we have landed. And everybody was laughing.
And there's a picture of the four, I think four of you, it's difficult to tell in that control, but I think four of you sort of gathered around a screen sort of looking at the numbers. Is that what sort of made a decision that you said, right, it's my call, I'm going to announce that it's landed?
Well, we started the, if you want, jumping around or joying when we saw that something, the radio link between the lander and Rosetta was very stable throughout the descent. And exactly at the time we had predicted the landing, then something changed. This link was briefly interrupted and resumed. Then we said, this is the landing, it's no doubt. I think we unambiguously identified the fact that we touched the surface of the comet.
We definitely confirmed that the lander is on the surface, and I leave it to Stefan. I think it's up to him to judge how it's going now on the lander.
Okay, so we are there, and Fila is talking to us. First things he told us was that the harpoons have been fired, rewound, and the landing gear has been moved inside, so we are sitting on the surface. Fila is talking to us, more data to come.
If you compare the situation at ESOC, for ESA's mission control, to the lander mission control in Cologne, they're very different parallel stories.
My name is Koen Geurts, and I'm the Rosetta Lander Technical Manager. Here in Cologne, we were also looking at this information, and we had the anchor experts sitting next to us. And they immediately were saying between themselves, saying, something happened, but it doesn't look exactly what we expected. So this, when you hear this, and let's say behind you, you're not going to jump up immediately. So you're waiting on what they're saying. And what we also saw, and this was, let's say, the most concerning, but also the most unambiguous confirmation that we were not standing on the comet, is that we still saw this rotation. So we saw that the solar panels, the rotation changed, it was a bit different, but it was still rotating. And with every, let's say, minute passing, we saw that the rotation was not decaying. So this meant we were still somewhere in free space. This moment struck us. I mean, okay, we touched down, we got confirmation that the anchors were not shot, and we see rotation. And then, of course, many people started to discuss and come with theories, and there was nothing that we could do.
Were you concerned that it wouldn't come back down, that it could just fly off into space?
What nobody could tell at the moment is how high, with which force, and if this force was sufficient to put Philly back into an escape trajectory, i.e. nobody could tell us that 2 hours later we would be landing again, and there was nothing that we could do.
And when did you next realize it had landed again? Because this is the second landing.
At the moment, we only saw the first touchdown and the final landing. Everything, all the results that were then derived, that we know now that we had also, intermediate touchdowns, we did not immediately see them. Fortunately enough, we still had communication between Rosetta and Philae. And at some point, we saw that this rotation immediately stopped. So we saw continuously rotating, rotation, rotation, and suddenly everything was stable. And this, of course, could only mean that we touched something, and the only thing there would be the comet. And we still had communication. So this was a very, a moment with a lot of relief that, okay, this means we're standing on the comet, we're still communicating. Perfect.
Koen Geurts, who's in charge of power on the Philae lander, former mission manager Fred Janssen, spacecraft operations manager Andrea Akamatso, and mission scientist Matt Taylor. I think it is quite interesting to hear them all together, isn't it? You get this sort of perspective across.
It certainly is, because it plays differently to how it was at our end. What was it like? Because you were with the journalists in the press room. Did you have any idea that any of this was taking place?
Yeah, I think it became quite obvious to me that things hadn't gone completely according to plan. Because we were in the press room, we were removed from all those wild celebrations that were going on up in the VIP area and which got so much coverage. And there was still this sense that the lander control team were not celebrating. And things started to seem a little bit confused. So it was clear that something had gone wrong. It'd been quite clear that something had gone wrong much earlier in the day on those overnight go no go, when the Philae go was delayed by at least an hour.
Were you aware of what had actually happened, or did that sort of leak out?
Because I was aware of what happened with the lander itself in the preparations overnight.
Wasn't fully working. Yeah.
Yes, because Fred Janssen and Matt Taylor briefed us very, very early in the morning, just on almost like a one-on-one. I mean, they were so open and honest that you really felt part of the process.
I think that is one of the great things about this, actually. There's been no attempt. The confusion there is genuine confusion. It was genuine confusion at the time that at ESOC they thought it's landed, big celebration, and actually in Cologne things were going slightly differently. There was no attempt to mislead anyone, even though there was probably pressure to do that.
I think everyone was genuine and authentic. And I truly got that feeling. So even after the official briefings, they wouldn't all just walk away. They'd then come and talk to you one-on-one, and I felt a huge sense of being part of it. I felt there was nothing being covered up. If there was parts of the story that weren't quite fitting together, it's because there was genuine confusion.
One of the things that was quite obvious, as you said, was the fact that you have several screens, you have several images, and I was in with the team doing the live broadcast. And at the time, we were looking at, like you say, the sort of woohoo, whoops and delight in one room. And then in the other room, it was almost as if when we were saying, what's going on? Why aren't they reacting? And at first, we thought they didn't have the feed, that they'd missed somehow the signal, or that they hadn't seen the control room. So they were unaware. So that was our first thought, and other people's thought. It's like, well, what's going on? Why? Because they were just sat there. They weren't celebrating. Then we thought, okay, if they're not doing that and they have got it, something, and like you say, you then think, okay, they've detected something that we haven't. And then afterwards, we were getting scientists coming up to us saying, no, it's still in flight. It's still there. It's landed, but it's no longer there. And as that lovely sort of step by step sort of trace of what went on, then it all makes sense in terms of the readings that they were getting. But it was odd, wasn't it, to see them all sat there like mannequin dummies.
And you just thought, are they being completely, totally, massively professional and just getting on with the job, but actually there were no smiles. No. And so suddenly you start realizing that something's not right, and then all the press briefings, the official briefings, kept being put back later. Yes, and later and later,
because they were finding out. Absolutely. What was going on, because we had scientists running in and out of where we were saying, we don't know yet. Yes. We're still trying to work it out.
Yeah, absolutely right. And it gave us, in a strange way, it gave the most extraordinary sense of drama.
Yeah.
To the whole thing, and that, I think, is going back to that original question, is one of the other reasons why this captured people's attention, because it is dramatic.
One thing that Kuhn Gertz told me, we heard about the thruster not working, which was public knowledge, as you say. He says actually that saved the mission. So they've worked out since that had that thruster worked, it would have pushed the Philae lander down into the surface. Harpoons didn't fire, actually would have effectively loaded it like a spring, and it would have bounced out, would have reached escape velocity, and wouldn't have gone back to the comet. So actually, the two failures were fine. If that thruster had worked and the harpoons hadn't worked, then it would have gone off into space.
I know, this what-if game was something that we were playing all day, because the press centre had opened at 6 a.m. and knowing that there'd been a problem with Philae overnight, because I'd been watching it overnight from the hotel, I was straight in at 6 to try and find out what the problem was, and that's when we were told that the thrusters weren't, there's no pressure in the lines, and so the harpoons should fire, but then there's the recoil that might happen there, and all the rest of it. So we were on tenterhooks. We knew it wasn't a done deal that this would happen. And I've come to the opinion, actually, that it doesn't now matter how Philae got to the surface and stayed on the surface. All that matters is that it did.
And in fact, as a result of the multiple touchdowns, which I thought Fred Jansen dealt with very well by turning it into an advantage, actually, in terms of the science, it has been an advantage, because each time it touched down, the instruments were still taking data. So, for example, with the magnetic field measurements of the comet, that was actually helped by the fact that they now have measurements from four different points, and similarly with other aspects of it. So in terms of the science, it has actually been an unexpected boon to have data from four different points.
Yes, Ian Wright from the Open University was saying something very similar, that his instrument was open all that time and has collected an extraordinary amount of data from this journey across the comet. The interesting thing is, of course, that there were discussions originally about whether many years ago, whether this mission should be a comet hopper. So, and it was decided that it was just too difficult to try and hop across a comet, so let's just try and make one that would land in a single place. So everyone won, really.
That's great. I love the thought of a hopper, an unintentional hopper actually happens. But then, of course, the big question now is, will Philae wake up? It sort of doesn't have to, in a way, because it's completed its primary science mission. It sent back 57 hours worth of data, the difficulty being it's slightly in shadow, so it's not going to get, in fact, it's only a fraction of like an hour and a half, I believe, of sunlight it's likely to get, as opposed to pretty much a whole day's worth. Do you think it's important for it to wake up? I know the drama will continue and everyone will be delighted, but is there much more to gain?
If Philae doesn't wake up, the science is exceptional already. If it does wake up, and again, I'm going to rely on Ian Wright for this, and he said to me that they've got their data, and they've got data that they, you know, that they were hoping for. So now they can analyse that, and they can build hypotheses. In the usual run of things, they would then have to wait two decades or so for another mission to go to a comet and test their hypotheses. If Philae wakes up, they can do it this year. So if Philae wakes up, it's just bonus science, and it's shortcutting taking another mission.
That's great, isn't it? So another unintentionally positive side effect of a unexpected bounce landing.
Yes, absolutely. So in the normal run of things, Philae's mission would now be completely over. It would have overheated by now. The fact that it's in this crevasse or wherever it is, and mostly in the shadow and in the cold, is protecting it. And as it goes closer towards the sun and the activity rises, and if it does wake up, that extra activity will only, I think, allow its instruments to take better data.
And we should remind people, actually, that the maximum activity and the closest it will be to the sun is August.
That's absolutely right.
Well, Philae technical manager Koen Gertz from the German space agency DLR is definitely the man who is probably closest to letting us know whether Philae will wake up or not. He's responsible for power systems on the lander. And Richard, you met him, didn't you, at the control room in Cologne?
We're overlooking the lander room here. It's around the size, I suppose, of a tennis court. Big glass wall on this side so we can see in. And the tables are arranged not like the sort of NASA control room in rows. They're arranged in a circle. And you've got the various posts around. There's ops, there's power, there's CMD. I'm not sure what CMD is. Commanding, okay. Thermal, all those are around in a circle. And then on the far wall, screens with projected graphs, statistics, and it says on the top right-hand corner, time to event. Tell me what that is, first of all, and we'll talk about the rest of the room.
The time to event is the time until Rosetta loses communication with Earth.
So right now Rosetta is communicating with Earth, and that's green. Is that why that's green?
Exactly, correct.
And what's going on in the room? There's only one person in here, not surprisingly, right now.
At the moment, of course, it's very quiet because Philae is in hibernation. We're just doing some standard system checks. We have, unfortunately, no communication with Philae, so there's nothing, let's say, for us to do actively here in the control room. Over the weekend, we were listening for possible communication with Philae. So what colleagues are doing are simply having a look if the system part on Rosetta was operating normally.
And the communication with Philae is via Rosetta?
Correct. So we rely on Rosetta to establish communication between Rosetta and Philae, RF communication, and of course rely on ESA to send our commands to Rosetta.
Have you always got someone in here just in case there comes a signal?
Not always, because we are listening for our signals only at dedicated time intervals. Also then, for example, over the weekend, we were not staffing the control room because we would be informed by our colleagues at ESA. They have permanent staffing, but we are on call. So in case we would get a signal on Sunday afternoon, then we all quickly come in.
And what are the chances, do you think? I mean, having analysed the data coming back from Rosetta, and the position now, you think, where the lander might be?
for example, over the weekend, we had very good possibilities in terms of geometry, because Philae and Rosetta have to look at each other in a specific geometry for the communication to be able to be established. And the geometry, so the communication slots, were relatively long in duration, 2 to 3 hours. Of course, this has to occur also during the daylight period where Philae has landed, otherwise Philae is shut down. We did not receive any signal because the tendency is, or our belief is, that it's still relatively cold where Philae has landed. So Philae has to reach at least minus 45 degrees Celsius. At the moment, it's probably a bit too early still.
So if we imagine it there, is it effectively like a laptop with a flat battery and it needs charging up from its solar cells? Is that the bottom line, really?
Exactly. And for this charging or even booting, so switching on, Philae can also switch on without having charged its batteries, so running exclusively on solar power, but it needs to reach this minimum temperature, otherwise we might damage some of our electronics. So there's a hardware mechanism which is preventing switch on in case the temperature is too low.
And judging from its position, I mean, all we can see really are those final images. You can see one leg. It looks like it's on its side in something of a gully. What are the chances of getting sunlight into that area?
There is sunlight. This we also saw immediately following the landing during a few days. Unfortunately, the sunlight isn't as long in duration as we would have hoped. So there we are calculating with 2 to 3 hours of good illumination. Our big advantage is that the comet is getting closer and closer to the sun. So the intensity is much higher with respect to the intensity in November. So for this short duration, we have a good chance in terms of power that Philae will be able to boot.
And so hope is not lost. You're looking ahead to the next, few months, maybe July, August, that sort of time.
Exactly. Perihelion, so the closest sun to comet distance, is mid-August. So up to mid-August, every day our chances are increasing. So in this respect, it looks positive for the lander.
Koen Goertz from the Philae lander team. I'm quite surprised how optimistic he is, actually, because there's been a general play down that it won't wake up. I mean, he's the guy in charge of the power.
Yeah, and he's an engineer. So, you know, if you're going to believe optimism from anyone, believe it from an engineer. Yeah.
I have to say, that was recorded end of April, so that's the sort of timescale we're talking about. But he does seem to think it's getting closer and closer and closer. And of course, it could happen after it's got to its closest point to the sun as well.
Yeah, so we would imagine that the main illumination is going to come around perihelion time. So that's when, you know, the best chances of it in the run-up to that and before. We keep our fingers crossed.
This is the Space Boffins podcast with Sue Nelson, Richard Hollingham and our guest Stuart Clark, brought to you in partnership with The Naked Scientists. Do get in touch on Twitter or Facebook, and that's where you'll find interesting comments from Robin Haig on the somewhat secretive Blue Origins rocket project, space hygiene tips from ESA astronaut Samantha Cristoforetti, and a picture of a Beagle 2 pen, which still works. Although, as I pointed out on Facebook, it's really difficult to get the lid off. I also want to mention Space Boffins listener David Milligan. He's the Gaia spacecraft operations manager. We'll hear from him on the Space Boffins podcast maybe next month. I met him at ESOC in Germany the other week, and he found us via the Naked Astronomy podcast feed, where you'll now find us. And I think a lot of people have found us that way. And we'll have more news for astronomy fans in next month's podcast.
Thank you very much to our guest, science writer, journalist, novelist, and musician, Stuart Clark.
The Space Boffins podcast is a Boffin Media production in partnership with The Naked Scientists. We're supported by the Atrium Space Insurance Consortium. Do follow us and contact us on Facebook and Twitter. And thanks for listening.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.